Hello and welcome to Beyond Reproach. This is Tux Lurzel, and this is our summer break re-release series. Thank you for joining us. Today, I'm going to be introducing my favorite story from Beyond Reproach that Stephanie has ever done on our show. My favorite episode was episode 16, The Story of Henry Wallace. I think it's a really fun story, it's interesting, and it's somebody that I never really knew very much about at all. Honestly, I didn't really know anything about him. But the more that I learned, the more I realized that he is my favorite politician that I'd never heard of. He is what a politician should be. He's smart, he believes in science, he cares about people, and because of all that, he was completely railroaded. He was also adjacent to my girl, Eleanor Roosevelt, so I love that. And the story of what happened to him was totally crazy. It's a history-changing moment that happened in a matter of minutes. I often wonder what life could be like if Red Pepper had just gotten to that podium a minute earlier. We could have a Wallace, President Wallace, instead of a shitty warmongering little turd named Harry Truman. So let's jump back in and listen again to the story of Henry Wallace told by Stephanie.
My scandal this episode is the DNC of 1944, when the choice of running mate completely changed the course of American history. Tux, your face is amazing right now. I know that you know this.
I know. Yeah. I know enough about the story to be excited about it.
Yeah. We both watched the same documentary that mentioned this. It's on Netflix. It's Oliver Stone's Untold History of Untold History of the United States.
Yeah.
And when you said that you were watching it too, I'm just like, no, not my scandals. Yeah. My beautiful scandals.
I know. This story has been on my list.
Because I was like watching it, taking notes. I have so many scandals from it.
You know, these stories, the Castle Bravo and stuff, came from that too. He barely talks about them, but like...
Yeah, like a few sentences. Mm-hmm. Like, hey, we did this thing in the Bikini Atoll. The end.
I started researching it because of that.
Really? Yeah. Okay. Shit. Fantastic. So at this convention, Henry A. Wallace, FDR's current VP, is dropped. He is dumped by the right wing of the Democratic Party in favor of Harry S. Truman. So this is the single most consequential vice presidential choice in modern times. And it all happened in the blink of an eye, behind closed doors, away from the public. He's dumped like he's an original member of Destiny's Child. Like, his name is Latavia or Latoya. He's here one day, he's gone the next. It is fucked up.
Yeah.
So backroom dealing and party politics are as old as parties themselves, as we learned in episode 3. In the background for the Alien and Sedition Act, I talked about how in our very first election, there was instances of delegate voter manipulation. So this is something that politics emerged early in our young republic. It has never left. So did you know that FDR had not one or two, but three different VPs? Did you know that?
Three? No, I didn't realize three.
Oh.
I knew that there were two. I knew that Truman was different from Wallace.
Yeah.
Who's the third?
Garner is his last name. He served for two terms, and then it was...
Oh.
Yeah.
I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah, two terms, and then it was Wallace, and then it was Truman for the fourth term.
Okay.
In modern times, we kind of think that the presidency is a package deal. At least that's kind of how I think.
Yeah. Well, that's like in the last episode, Andrew Johnson was Lincoln's second VP.
It was not always the case.
Yeah, I didn't.
At all.
Yeah.
Because people died and like just there were a lot of different reasons why the VP kind of shuffled. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it drastically changed the course of history, as is in this case. So we must remember that FDR did not get elected as the progressive we know him as today.
Yeah.
I'm going to say that again for the people in the back. FDR did not get elected as the progressive we know him as today because he was part of the Democratic Party. And this is the Democratic Party before the switch.
Yes. He was sort of instrumental in like the beginning of the switch. But
definitely. He came for President Hoover from the right, like his predecessor.
Wow.
Yeah, for being a big spender and for unbalancing the budget.
I did not
know that. So he was out in the street like talking muy caliente, like prior to taking office. Yes. So this is not the Democratic Party that we know and hate.
Yeah.
Is what I was trying to say. The party has always had a mixed legacy, but progressive promise wasn't really the consistent vibe until the mid-1930s. Democrats were still the very, like, racist small government types, while Republicans supported a powerful federal government. But sometime between the 1860s and 1936, things start to change. The party of small government became the party of big government. The party of big government at least became rhetorically committed to curbing federal power. So historians say, this is like a little side note, that Republicans have always been the party of bigger business. It's just that in the earlier era, the bigger businesses wanted a bigger government because they needed things from the government, like infrastructure, they needed a currency, they needed tariffs, they needed all these things. But in the modern era, it's like, we got this thing. Like, we don't need you anymore.
We don't need more of it.
Yeah. So they're like, I don't know you, girl.
When they say small government, generally it does not mean an actual smaller government than we currently have. What they want is just the same size government in the hands of fewer people.
Yes. And not looking at business.
Yeah.
With scrutiny.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because it's in the hands of business,
exactly.
Essentially.
Yeah. They want to just be like, I don't know you. Like,
yeah.
Big business and government, they like see each other on the subway and like hiding.
We've never met.
We've never met. You have me confused. I'm not me. So yeah, so this shift in ideology was largely due to the rise of a really powerful labor movement that was just coming online. It became the new backbone of the Democratic Party. President Roosevelt's smashing victory in 1936. I don't know if you've seen the electoral map.
No.
For 19. Okay. I've never seen a map like this before in my life.
Which year again?
1936. His second term in office. So I'm just going to show you the map. Thank you for having that reaction. Yes. So it revealed that the political landscape had shifted.
God, what is that? One state, Maine?
Maine and Vermont are the only states that didn't go for the Democrats. Vermont and Maine.
That's insane.
The whole thing.
Also, I feel like Vermont and Maine are now considered pretty progressive, which is a funny...
It's crazy. So things had really shifted. With FDR at its head, the Democratic Party put together a really formidable coalition from coastal intellectuals to lower income groups in the big cities. So like union members, recent immigrants, religious minorities, together with the traditional source of Democratic power, the South.
Yeah.
It is everyone except for Vermont and Maine that's together in this coalition.
I'm trying to picture what the political landscape must have been then.
Look at you thinking over there.
I need to just drink rum and stop. Turn my brain off.
Think quieter. Okay. So the great migration of Black Americans from the terrorism in the South to the urban North started in 1910 and really gained a lot of steam in the 40s because of World War II.
Yeah.
So they were moving up to the North, and of course there was still segregation, there was still racism, there was still discrimination in housing and employment, but at least they were allowed to vote. They could vote without dying in the North. Even though FDR wasn't super committed to civil rights in any meaningful way at the time, they broke with the party of Lincoln for the first time and they voted for FDR in this election.
Wow.
So FDR claimed, and he was, I think, definitely correct, he claimed that endorsing any legislation that threatened the South's racial order would cost him the votes of the Southerners in Congress. Votes that he desperately needed to get his New Deal policies passed.
Yeah.
So he wrote the New Deal in a way that it could be applied in unequal ways, basically. That the South could...
In unequal ways.
In equal
yes, absolutely.
Ways. Yeah. It was the only way, because the South, they don't want equality.
No.
It would have been destabilizing. And he would have lost all of the South, which was...
Oh, it's so hard for me to keep my mouth shut through this, because I know too much.
I'm like...
The racist ways the New Deal was put into place in the South.
I haven't really looked at that in depth, but I know that it was fucked up. So maybe I'll let you handle that, and I just won't even look into it.
I don't know. I mean, it's one of those stories where, like...
Is it any worse than the story you just fucking told? Okay.
That's true. That is true.
I am not okay.
Will we ever be the same again?
I have therapy on Tuesday night, so we will be talking about this. So FDR was a pragmatic politician in a coalition landscape, and he sort of just rode the wave. He wasn't like super ideological. He could get down with progressive values if it meant winning in saving capitalism. His stronghold on this really wide variety of voters was largely due to the social, political, economic, and cultural changes that were happening at the time. So it was the Great Depression, it was the New Deal, and World War II. So there's just like so many things happening at once.
Yeah.
So there's this rising tide of liberalism, like a coming right now. So when Henry A. Wallace came on the scene, he became the most vocal part of a really growing progressive wing of the party that was at odds with the Southern Democrats. A quick bit about him. I'm not going to go too in detail because I'm just obsessed. He was born the third Henry Wallace to a family with really deep agricultural roots. R. Henry was a plant geneticist by profession. Did you know that?
No.
Yeah, he was a scientist. He would go on to develop the first commercially successful hybrid corn.
Wow.
A scientist. Okay. Yeah. Huh. When his father, who served as the Secretary of Agriculture for President Warren G. and Calvin C.
Huh, okay.
When his father died, Henry became a national farming authority by default. As a family, the Wallaces were Republican, but the shock of the Great Depression had a really big impact on rural America, and it forced Henry to reevaluate his politics. In 1932, Wallace supported Franklin Roosevelt, who in turn elected Wallace as his Secretary of Agriculture. So he got his, like, dad's old job.
Wow, okay.
Again, Henry Wallace to me is one of the most fascinating political figures in American history. The documentary on Netflix really, like, talks him up because he was so revolutionary in so many ways.
Yeah.
And I didn't learn about him in school. Did you ever learn about... Yeah, right?
Not at all.
And I... It's crazy.
I would think a lot of the listeners today probably have never even heard of him.
Yeah, it took me forever to write this outline because it kept sounding like a fawning book report. Just like, I love Henry Wallace, let me count the ways. Sort of thing. I'm like, okay.
Stephanie Wallace.
Yeah. It's like me and a heart. It's like S plus H equals, yeah. So he was a serious, really serious guy. Like, he was an author, he was a lecturer, he was a very, very committed social rights advocate. He was a New Deal hype man, basically. Like, he was truly down for the cause, and he had a large, really devoted following because of it. So he, in 1940, was the most popular Democrat in the country.
In 1940. Okay. Wow.
Second to only FDR.
Yeah.
Their wartime president.
Yeah, sure.
So everyone loves him, basically. But he was a very easy man to make fun of.
Okay. Nerd.
Yeah. To these tough party loyalists, Wallace seemed to have his head in the clouds.
Mm.
He was always reading and trying to know things.
Loser.
The machine never wanted him as VP. They thought him too liberal, too internationalist, too soft.
Okay, yeah.
And also they didn't trust him because he only recently became a Democrat.
Oh, yeah,
because
yeah.
Because his family was Republican, and the Great Depression caused them to switch. But it also didn't help that Henry was a Buddhist mystic who spoke Russian and played with a boomerang and apparently consulted with the spirit of a dead Sioux Indian chief.
Oh, okay.
I'm not going to say anything about that because I'm going to revisit Wallace in other ways.
Okay.
So I'm just gonna leave that there and move on real quick. So again, FDR wasn't ideological. He didn't mind that Wallace was such an oddball because he was a popular oddball.
Sure.
Okay. Everyone loved him. FDR wanted an outspoken anti-fascist on the ticket, which Wallace was, given what he predicted we would be up against in the 40s.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it was good to have someone that was like very committed to anti-fascism.
Before Antifa was a bad word.
You guys, this was back when we all knew Nazis were bad. I like that you laugh. You almost spit your drink out. Oh, my God.
Imagine an entire nation believing that Nazis are bad.
Right? Yeah.
Americans? Never.
We were such a young country. Oh, so naive. Leading up to the convention, FDR wrote that we already have one conservative Wall Street-dominated party in the U.S., the Republicans. And if Democrats aren't going to be a liberal pro-social justice party, they have no reason to exist.
Yeah.
So he threatened to turn down the nomination if he couldn't get Wallace as his VP.
Wow.
Yeah. So FDR is starting to get a little woke, and it's all because of Eleanor.
Eleanor.
Eleanor loved Wallace, loved everything he stood for. They were great friends.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Eleanor is the reason that Wallace was even on his radar.
Huh.
Shocking,
okay.
Right?
Yeah.
Shocking. So she really is the reason why we had Wallace at all as VP.
Wow.
She took to the convention in 1940, and she warned everyone that their beloved wartime president would not run for a third term. He was going to take his ball and go home if he couldn't have Wallace on the ticket.
Wow.
She said this all in this really amazing speech. It's, yeah, I'm gonna link it in the show notes. It's incredible. Okay. So they, the right-wing machine operatives who controlled the party behind the scenes, they begrudgingly agreed to have Wallace on the ticket in 1940. So as the New Deal was losing momentum, Wallace became its most forceful defender. At the same time, he anticipated problems that were not yet on many people's minds. He was so ahead of his time.
This is, again, 1940.
This is 1940, yes.
Okay.
This is 1940. So he wrote that, quote, probably the most damaging indictment that can be made of the capitalistic system is the way in which its emphasis on unfettered individualism results in the exploitation of natural resources in a manner to destroy the physical foundations of national longevity. Exactly.
I'm gooped. I literally...
Right?
We were saying...
Climate
somebody was saying
change.
This in the 40s?
The 1940.
How?
Because he's a scientist, though.
Oh, my
God. He's a plant geneticist. He's like, oh, shit.
Before, like, climate change was even, like, a thing that we would even
Before it was a Chinese hoax, you mean.
Wow.
Yes, right?
I need to find my trapper keeper. Cross out.
Why?
Cross out Eleanor.
Oh, yes.
And put Wallace in my heart.
You can be a
my trapper keeper. Yeah. Ooh.
You gave me that word when you were talking about what's his name with the eyebrows?
Warren. Or no.
No, Levy.
Levy.
Yeah.
Yeah. The whole corn thing, too, is like his research led him to, like, have modified corn, and now we're, like, getting into GMO shit.
Yeah.
Like, he didn't know where his research was going to go.
He didn't know, but he was a curious person, and everyone was on that march towards progress.
The goal was just more food for...
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's why he did it.
Yeah.
That's why he did it.
They didn't know we would be getting into
He's
some, like,
this
Monsanto
is a more efficient
shit.
Way to propagate corn. Oh, he's amazing. So, do you know who Henry Luce is?
No.
He is a newspaper. He was a newspaper magnate. He owned, like, every magazine. He owned Time, Life, Sports Illustrated, Fortune. Like, he was he owned everything. He was the most influential private citizen of his day.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, by far, because he owned all of these
real
media.
Real life Citizen Kane.
Yes.
Yeah.
Actually, yes. Correct. He wrote that, quote, the 20th century must be the American century, and that the U.S. should dominate the world militarily, economically, culturally, etc. He wrote this long, like, really long piece, I think, in Life.
Okay.
About how this is our century, this is our time. Britain is declining. Like, it is our time after the war to, like, rise up.
Funny to think about, like, this was the mindset at that time.
Yeah.
And, like, looking forward to where we are now when we're on the decline.
So I think it was in Oliver Stone's documentary, I think it was Churchill who said, if it is really going to be the American century, may God help us all.
It's a shame that God didn't help us all. And here we are, 2019.
So Wallace counters with a really rousing speech on why the 20th century must be the century of the common man. And he calls for a worldwide people's revolution. He said, some have spoken, quote, of the American century. I say that the century on which we are entering, the century which will come out of this war, can and must be the century of the common man. There must be neither military nor economic imperialism, international cartels that serve American greed, and the German will to power must go. The people's revolution is on the march, and the devil and all of his angels cannot prevail against it. Yeah.
Damn. Big words.
Big words. He was such a great orator.
Yeah.
He was amazing. He spoke from the heart. Like, you could tell that he really cared.
Damn.
And
this
he's
is
like,
another, like,
it should not be the American century. It needs to be everyone. Like, it shouldn't be one big superpower fucking everyone over again. Like, we need to be in this together.
Yeah. This is another Shirley Chisholm situation where no one was listening.
Yeah, sure was. Yeah. So I'm doing, like, in my head, I've said, like, every season I'm going to do one person who's just the best and no one knows about them.
Yeah.
So I did Shirley Chisholm, and, like, Wallace is my next one for season two.
The season two Chisholm. Yeah.
Yeah. So it is Wallace who knew that fascism could come here. He knew that this was not strictly a problem of Europe. Also known as Europe.
Europe.
He said that American fascists are those who put Wall Street first and the American people second.
Big facts.
Yeah.
So, coming at you.
So he's basically talking about the contemporary Democratic and Republican parties.
Yeah.
However, he said American fascism wouldn't be a problem unless three conditions are met. Quote, American fascism will not be really dangerous until there's a purposeful coalition amongst the cartelists. That's one. The deliberate poisoners of public information. That's two. And those who stand for the KKK type demagoguery. Three. I mean, he didn't number them, but I did. But I'm like, oh, we're hitting all three.
Okay.
Yeah.
So essentially, he was just like, he was the oracle.
Yeah. He was reading 2019.
Yeah.
From the 40s.
Yeah. Oh, man.
Right? So I have a clip.
When these opportunities are open to everyone, then the world moves straight ahead. But in countries where the ability to read and write has been recently acquired, mind you, 62% of the people of the world today do not yet know how to read and write. But in those countries where the ability has been recently acquired, or where the people have had no long experience in governing themselves on the basis of their own thinking, it is easy for demagogues to arise and prostitute the mind of the common man to their own base end. Such a demagogue may get financial help from some person of wealth who is unaware of what the end result will be. With this backing, the demagogue may dominate the minds of the people, and from whatever degree of freedom they have, lead them back into a most degraded slavery. Herr Thiessen, the wealthy German steel man, little realized what he was doing when he gave Hitler enough money to enable him to play on the minds of the German people. The demagogue is the curse of the modern world.
Right?
Damn.
So to make matters even worse, he was the leading spokesman for civil rights. He called for equal pay for equal work, regardless of race or sex.
Oh, my word.
So across the board, he represents everything we see as good with American progressivism. And they hated him for it. So he would be more of a Liz Warren type person, minus the really shameful Native American appropriation. Because Wall Street was like pissing in their britches at the thought of him becoming president.
Yeah.
So 44 is when the next election has happened. This is like leading up to the convention. There was still a lot of really strong support for Wallace, despite his leftist leanings. Like, people loved him.
Mm-hmm.
Like, everyone loved him.
I love him.
Yeah, I love now. Him too.
Yeah.
But Edwin Pauley, who was the DNC treasurer and just resident busybody, he ran what he called the Pauley's coup. Super creative. He proudly referred to his coup by name like a loser. Him and his homies basically plotted to dump Wallace. Pauley was an oil tycoon from California, a really big fundraiser who just so happened to be besties with Truman.
Okay.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So he, in conjunction with Bob Hannigan, who was the DNC chair, they had the Bronx boss, Edward Flynn. They had Chicago's mayor, Ed Kelly, who's big trash. They had key labor leaders and other party like movers and shakers. They viewed Wallace as a huge liability for his leftist leanings. So these people ran a very targeted operation to get Truman elected VP behind Wallace's back. Like, wow. They actually prevented Wallace's supporters, like delegates that would have supported him, from having access to FDR.
I can't yeah. say that I'm surprised, but
right?
Holy shit.
There was a very deep division over who Roosevelt should choose as a running mate. For his fourth term, exactly.
Yeah, okay.
For a reason that really transcended political boundaries, for the reason that he was dying. FDR was really, really weak by 1944.
I was just going to say, like, yeah. He knew that he was sick.
It was clear to everyone.
Everyone around him knew he was
yeah,
sick.
Yeah, it seemed clear to everyone but him that he wasn't going to make it through a fourth term. So for that reason, the stakes were higher because yeah. it was like electing a president.
100%.
Because it would be electing a president. And there was no shortage of hopeful candidates because of it.
Yeah.
But Truman wasn't one of them.
Because he's a fucking turd.
Exactly.
But, sorry, but Truman's a turd.
He totally was. So FDR, it's hard to know what he was really doing. He was doing a lot in 1944. So FDR hating to disappoint and alienate any of his potential candidates, VP candidates, kept them all guessing. This is so crazy. So at lunch with Wallace, Roosevelt told him that even though Truman's qualifications were limited, the party machine preferred him because he had no enemies. So Truman was a failed shopkeeper who rose to the Missouri Senate with the help of a powerful boss in Kansas City named Tom Pendergrass, who, after he was turned down by four different people, four dudes said no. He selected Truman saying, quote, "I wanted to demonstrate that a well-oiled machine could send an office boy to the Senate."
An office boy.
I know, it's so upsetting. However, Roosevelt promised Wallace that he would not endorse another candidate. He would notify the convention that if he were a delegate, he would vote for Wallace. Which is such a weird, like, that's not an endorsement. Especially
not at all.
Especially from 1940, like, when Wallace was his ride or die, saying, like, if I can't have you, I'm, like, I'm burning this shit down. We're gonna, like, Thelma and Louise this shit.
What happened in the last 4 years? I mean,
I think it's just he's so sick.
But he's tired,
but who fucking knows? But yeah, that's...
By this point, he's been president for, what, 12 years already?
So if I were a delegate, I would vote for you. Like, that's not an endorsement at all.
Yeah.
But that's what he told Wallace. Another VP candidate was a man named James Burns, who went by Jimmy. Yeah. I'm like, that disqualifies you. I'm sorry. There's not going to be a VP Jimmy anything. Get the fuck out of here.
Carter, right?
Oh, shit. Jimmy is stupid. Sorry, Carter. Jimmy is stupid. It just is.
Tim, you know what to do with that.
So Jimmy Burns, he was FDR's right hand, who oddly enough asked Truman to nominate him at the convention. And they were all kind of friends.
Yeah.
So at the same time, the president held out hopes to Burns, telling him that he was the best qualified man for the whole outfit and urged him to stay in the race. He said, "After all, Jimmy, you're close to me, personally, and I hardly know Truman." So despite encouraging both Wallace and Burns, FDR had written a letter for Hannigan, who's the DNC chair again, to carry to the convention that wrote, "Dear Bob, you've written me about Harry Truman and Bill Douglas." Bill Douglas was a Supreme Court justice at the time.
Okay.
He says, "I should, of course, be very glad to run with either one of them and believe that either one of them would bring real strength to the ticket." I don't know what's going on, but he's just being really ambiguous with everything.
Yeah. It's so weird. I didn't really know any of this.
I know. Like, reading it, I was like, I don't get why he's doing it. And no one knows why he was doing this. People just think that maybe he was just getting really, really sick. And
yeah. He was.
So meanwhile, Senator Truman continued to deny any interest in the vice presidency. In an off-the-record interview, he explained to a reporter that he did not want to subject his family to the negative publicity involved in a national campaign. It turns out that both him, his wife, and his sister were on his payroll, his Senate payroll, so that's, that's probably why. But his wife and his mom wanted him to stay in the Senate. Yeah, it's like, why is your mom commenting on this? You're 50, but okay.
FDR's mom also had a lot of influence too. So
yeah. So do you know who said that the vice president simply presides over the Senate and sits around hoping for a funeral?
No, but I love them for saying that.
Truman. Truman said this.
Wow.
Because again, he did not want to be VP. So he was speaking honestly. The VP to him was a position of honor and no real power. He wanted to be majority leader.
Okay.
He wanted real power.
Sure. Okay.
So the VP is just sitting around like breaking ties? Like,
I mean, I get that, but at the same time, like, he had to see the writing on the wall. He had to see how sick.
He's not bright.
Yeah, he's not bright.
He's not bright.
He's
not bright.
I hate to drag the man, but like, he is the pre GW.
He's the only one who didn't see anything.
Yeah. He's essentially like the George W. Bush of the 1940s. Absolutely.
The fact that he would say this, knowing that the president is sick, but like, not a clue in the world.
FDR died, what, 80 days into his fourth term?
Yeah, 3 months. Yeah, less than 3 months away. Yeah. But the bosses wanted him for this role. Wallace was too radical. Jimmy Burns was equally vulnerable because he had a segregationist kind of history. They felt like that might, because things have shifted so much.
And people were more progressive at this point.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
Like, that was a hindrance for him. So when these party leaders expressed their opposition to Wallace and Burns, who were the front runners at the time, Roosevelt again suggested Supreme Court Justice Douglas. And it's like, why is this dude even in here? But okay. So the group again countered with Harry Truman, who Roosevelt agreed had been, quote, loyal and wise to the ways of politics, which I don't even know what that means. I guess he's a yes man.
Like, what are you even talking about, dude?
FDR is kind of losing it a bit. Oh. So after much discussion, apparently Roosevelt turned to Hannegan and conceded, Bob, I think you and everyone else here want Truman. So they finally wore him down, basically.
Yeah.
Now they just had to get Truman on board. Yeah.
Wow.
Right?
Okay.
So huddled in a hotel room.
Really?
This is during
the dude didn't even want it.
Not at all. Didn't want it at all. So huddled in a hotel room during the convention, the party bosses leaned heavily on Truman to run. He was, again, not for it. At the convention, he was still planning on nominating Burns.
Wow.
He wasn't trying to be coy. He did not want the job. So they placed a call to Roosevelt, who, despite his health, was on the campaign trail, which was shocking to me. Truman sat nearby and Hannegan held the phone so he could hear.
Sorry, but why are you on the campaign trail? You're in the middle of a war. People are going to vote for you.
Yeah. I think he was trying to prove his vitality.
Oh, that makes sense. Yeah.
It was a hard election year. Like, the Republicans were running a really strong candidate, so he had to be out and about.
He's also in a wheelchair, which, like, he thought that he had something to prove, too.
Yeah, so. I know. It's so sad. So Truman sat nearby because this phone call that's happening, and Hannegan held the phone so he could hear. He said, quote, Bob, have you got that fella lined up yet? Roosevelt asked. No, he's the contrariest Missouri mule I've ever met, Hannegan said. Well, you tell him that if he wants a break of the Democratic Party in the middle of the war, that's his responsibility. And he hung up.
The president has spoken.
Yeah. So stunned, Truman agreed to run because, duh, the president just said to run. And he said, why the hell didn't he tell me that in the first place? Which is legitimate.
Like, literally.
Legitimate. Like, why are we playing all these games with all these, like, the Supreme, Douglas is in here, like, Walt, like, just say this. Say what you mean.
What's going on with fucking Wallace at this point? Like, does he know this is happening?
Ugh. I mean, he suspects, like, his people, they don't have access.
Yeah.
The access that they once had to Roosevelt. Polly's coup is, like, keeping them at bay.
Okay.
So he knew that the party didn't want him.
Sure.
But he didn't know the levels of it. So,
and that, like, Roosevelt has already turned
yeah,
on
no,
it.
He did yeah. not know that. Okay. He did not know that at all. So, essentially, they cooked the convention. They stacked the DNC with anti-Wallace delegates. There's still one huge problem. Wallace is insanely popular. There's, like, thousands of labor leaders who've organized for him at the convention. So, a Gallup poll the opening day of the convention shows 65% of people wanted Wallace. 3% wanted Jimmy Burns. Truman is in 8th place with 2%. 8th. So Wallace was so popular the night of the convention starts, he made the second speech for Roosevelt, because I guess you have to be nominated and someone has to second you. Like, mm-hmm. That's how, like, the process goes. So even though the party bosses had the convention stacked and fixed, Wallace's rousing speech, a speech that was interrupted constantly by applause and shouts of "We want Wallace!" Like, he had to stop so many times. Like, I will put this in the show notes. The actual speech, he stopped like 20 different times of a short speech. Yeah. So after this, a spontaneous demonstration on the floor happens. It lasts for a whole hour. The people of the convention are on Wallace's side. They're singing. They're chanting.
It's a flash mob. Wallace flash mob.
I mean, kind of, yeah. Someone even hijacked the loudspeaker and started playing Wallace's campaign song. So a Wallace victory seemed certain. In the midst of the demonstration, there's a senator, a Florida senator named Claude Pepper, who was nicknamed Red Pepper because he was really progressive. When I saw that his nickname was Red Pepper, I'm like, is he like a ginger?
No, he's a red.
He's a red, yeah. He saw what was happening and he realized that if he could just get to the microphone and get Wallace's name in the nomination for VP, Wallace would be back on the ticket and he would sweep the convention that night if they voted.
Okay.
He kind of fought his way to the microphone and the party bosses, because they had like plants everywhere, they see that this is happening. So the Poly coup, they asked Mayor Kelly of Chicago, because the convention is happening in Chicago.
Uh-huh.
They asked Kelly to shut down the convention for the night due to a fire hazard.
To keep this guy from even nominating Wallace.
Exactly.
Holy shit.
They ordered the music to stop because, you know, when you chant loud enough for the wrong person, a fire starts.
Yeah.
The chairman of the convention later said that he had strict orders not to let Wallace get the nomination that night because they knew that it was the will of the people and Wallace would have been instantly back on the ticket. So he called for the meeting to be adjourned to prevent this vote. So he called, like, I have a motion to adjourn. All in favor, say aye. Maybe 3% say aye. All opposed, say nay. It's like thunderous nay. And he says the motion passed.
How did they get away with that?
It just did. Instantly, it's over.
Oh my God.
So Pepper was so close. He was 5 feet away, like literal seconds away from getting to the mic. Had he got to the microphone before it was adjourned, he would have been able to put Wallace.
And they would have changed history.
They would have had to vote that night.
Holy shit.
Yeah. So had he been a little bit faster, just like literally 5 seconds faster, a breath faster, Wallace would have been back on the ticket. He would have been voted in as VP that night. He would have become president in 1945 when 3 months after the inauguration, FDR drops dead instead of Truman. But instead, the following night on the first ballot, Wallace led Truman, but the party leaders swung their delegations on the second ballot and they put Truman over the top. And, you know, the rest was history.
This is insane. Wow.
We were so close.
And Truman, ugh, he's the worst.
Yeah.
I don't know if any of you have even heard Truman speak. He's a turd. He's just a turd.
Sure is.
And he also, fast forward, is the one who oversaw us getting into the fucking Marshall Islands and doing all these nuclear tests because he had a real hard on for like proving how masculine the United States was. And we had
he wanted to be a powerful man to show his mommy.
Literally, we could be living in a different world today.
Radically different.
If Red Pepper had gotten a minute faster.
Yeah. Back when Florida was doing good things.
Oh, Florida.
I know. This is when the Oh, Florida started.
I'm just picturing
he let us down.
Lisa Simpson.
Yeah.
I'm not a state. I'm a monster.
I'm a monster. Accurate.
Oh, damn.
Yeah, I know.
Is that?
That's it. The end. Wow. The end. Because I'm going to revisit Wallace, so I'm just like, I need to end it here. So, yeah. So this is the story of the convention. Holy shit. How fucking crazy is that?
I really want to know what Eleanor was doing while FDR was doing all... She had to have known, but at this point in history, she had her own shit going on.
Yeah, I think that's what it was. I think that's what it was, that they, like, there were people who were just, like, surrounding him, and she wasn't there.
Yeah, and probably didn't even really have that much access to him, because people knew what she was doing, too.
Yeah. No, she was part of the problem in their minds.
Yeah.
She wanted equal pay for equal work, commie.
Rights for black people? What the fuck are you thinking,
you crazy bitch? Rights for women? Women being paid like men? So that's the end of my scandal. I feel like it was a good balance because it was like a positive story.
I needed that.
I mean, it's not a positive story because the ending is horrible, but it's nothing compared to yours.
It's a fun story, though.
It's a fun story.
Just because Wallace is a fun character.
Yeah.
As you are well aware, I love the fucking Roosevelts.
Yeah, you do. You stan.
Should we?
Let's cheers it. Remaining bits of this delicious pina colada.
America's history is juicy.
Yes.
We just add rum and
pineapple.
Put the lime in the coconut.
Yes.
Add some pineapple juice in there somehow. I don't know how that equation works, but
throw it in an umbrella.
The pineapple is like the cosine, I think.
Oh, right? Yes.
Yes, a cocktail umbrella, no big deal, some tropical breezes. Mm-hmm. Anyways, thank you so much for listening to Beyond Reproach. This has been Tux Lurzel.
Stephanie Domingo.
Doot doot. Thank you to Tim Clough, our editor, sound engineer, and podfather. We literally could not do this without you. Special thanks to Brian Cowden, who provided some of the audio clips from my story.
Thank you.
And really helped with a lot of information. Thank you also to all of the vets who were interviewed in Brian's
documentary.
Brian's documentary, which we will link to in the show notes. We'll also try and put that on social media. And if anyone is interested in learning more about that story, please look up Brian's movie and find information. If you're interested in finding ways to help these guys, there's not many of them left. But if you do want to help, try to call your senators, call your representatives, and push them to vote for the Atomic Veterans Healthcare Parity Act, please. I don't want to get back into it, but yeah. Jesus, they need help.
Yeah.
You know? Thank you, everyone who helped in making this episode. Please do rate, review, and subscribe. Written reviews are especially important. If you like us, you know what to do. Leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. Leaving us a review there helps new people to find our podcast, and it also pushes our show up in the search bar so that it's easier to find us. So take a few seconds and do this if you have a moment. And also, send this episode to a friend or family member.
Or mortal enemy as a way of making peace.
You gotta do it somehow.
I mean,
it's been quite a journey.
Yes.
So I guess it's the end.
It's been the end.
Yes. Well, you know what happens when we drink too much? We drag out the ending.
And also we have a great time.
Yes. Was it as good for you as it is for me?
Oh, no. Tim. Tim, please save us.
Okay, on that note. Bye.
Bye. Beyond Reproach is proudly recorded in Bushwick, Brooklyn. New episodes are released the first and third Monday of every month. Please note that we are not historians. We are just a couple of drunks who never shut up and love history. Full list of all source information can be found in the show notes on our website. Please take a moment to rate, review, and subscribe. Written reviews are especially important. If you like us, please do one of two things. Leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or send this episode to a friend, family member, or someone you think would be into it. Don't forget to follow us on social media. Make sure you follow us on Instagram because we post our cocktail recipes the Thursday before each full episode. Please drink along with us if you are not driving. We also have a shop at beyondreproachpod.com. Get your merch, brand yourselves. We are on Patreon if anyone would love to show us some love and throw us some nickels to support the production of our show.